story is told about a classic car lover. He was looking for a particular model of Studebakers. Those of you, we are old enough to remember Studebakers. He was looking for a 1957 Golden Hawk. Studebaker was a pioneer in the American auto industry, known for its quality and its style. Elvis Presley had one, Frank Sinatra had one, so you know the class and the cost. This particular classic car lover came across a newspaper ad. And as he looked at the ad, it was impossible for him to believe it was true. Just the car he wanted was listed for $100. He knew that it couldn't be true. It must have been a misprint. He ignored it for a day, but decided, I got to investigate. I got to find out. So he called the number that was in on the ad, and the woman answered the phone and assured him that the car was in excellent running condition and it was exactly what he wanted. To his delight, when he saw the car, the woman's report was absolutely true. It was in immaculate condition, and it was only $100. He felt guilty, so he says to the woman, you realize, ma'am, that this car is worth thousands more than what you're asking. And she goes, oh, I know that. So, but you see, my husband left me to run off with his secretary. He sent me the title to the car and told me to sell it and send him the money. And that's what I intend to do with the $100. That story just kind of introduces Genesis chapter 29. Because there's poetic justice there. And I guess that's what you see when we get to the 29th chapter of Genesis. Because Jacob, the deceiver, gets deceived by his double-dealing uncle Laban. Jacob, who had deceived his father and his brother to gain a blessing, finds himself on the wrong end of a trick played on him by Laban. But it's not just Laban, but it's not just Jacob who gets betrayed. Rachel's cheated out of her wedding. Leah must have felt like a cheap substitute. And Jacob gets played for a fool. It's difficult to find a better example of poetic justice than the story of Jacob and Laban. Yet behind the scenes, or maybe in front of the scenes, this is not just a story about deceit, it's a love story. Jacob really loved Rachel. He was willing to give up 14 years of his life in order to have Rachel as his wife. And at the end of his life, as he lay on his deathbed, it's Rachel that he remembers, recalling the sorrowful time when he had laid her to rest. But this is not a fairy tale story ending. You don't get they lived happily ever after in this story. There was tension. There's deception. All of this led to Jacob waking up on the morning after his wedding, finding out that he's married the wrong woman. Turn to Genesis chapter 9. Excuse me, chapter 29. Genesis chapter 29, and we'll begin reading at verse 1, and I'm going to read the first 14 verses of this chapter. Jacob went on a journey, and he came to the land of the sons of the east. He looked. He saw a well in the field, and behold, three flocks of sheep were lying there beside it. For them, that well, they watered from that well they watered the flocks. Now the stone on the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, they would then roll the stone from one mouth of the well and water the sheep. And they'd put the stone back in its place on the mouth of the well. Jacob said to them, my brothers, where are you from? And they said, we're from Haran. And he said to them, do you know Laban, the son of Nahor? And they said, we do know him. And he said to them, is it well with him? And they said, it is well. And here is Rachel, his daughter, coming with the sheep. He said, "Behold, it's still high day. It is not time for the livestock to be gathered. Water the sheep. Go, pasture them." But they said, "We cannot until all the flocks are gathered, and they roll the stone from the mouth of the well. Then we water the sheep." And while he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. When Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob went up, rolled the stone from the mouth of the well, watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother, kissed Rachel, and lifted his voice and wept. Jacob told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and that he was Rebekah's son. She ran and told her father. So when Laban heard the news of Jacob, his sister's son, he ran to meet him, embraced him, kissed him, brought him to his house. Then he, Jacob, related to Laban all these things. And Laban said to him, "Surely you are a bone of my flesh." And he stayed with him a month. Jacob had left Bethel with a lightness in his step and a new lease on life. See, before his encounter with God, he could only refer to Yahweh as his father's God, your God. Chapter 27 and verse 20. Isaac said to his son, "How is it that you have so quickly, my son?" And he said, "Because the Lord, your God, caused it to happen to me." So he called him your God. But when he left Bethel, Yahweh was his God. Verse 21 of chapter 28. "And I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God." There had been a change in Jacob as a result of having his vision of the ladder from heaven and heard the promises of God about God's presence and God's provision and God's protection. His personal encounter with God was real. His new commitments were honest and sincere. He had the assurance of the return to the land, and the blessings that had been given to Abraham had been reiterated to him. There was a new sense of direction, a new hope, a new meaning of life. He was still on his way to Haran, but God, his God, was with him. The distance to Haran from where Jacob had left was about 450 miles. And he walked. Now, if he averaged 3 miles an hour, which is an average time of walking for a man on a level surface. And if you've been to Israel, it's not level. But if he averaged 3 miles an hour and he walked for 10 hours a day, and so he'd get about 30 miles a day, then it's going to take him a minimum of 15 days. But it probably took him much longer to walk that distance. It was no small task to walk. And he was alone. But this wasn't all Jacob's decision, because at the end of his life, he recognized that the Lord was directing his steps. Notice what he says at the end in Genesis chapter 45, verses 15 and 16. He kissed all his brothers and wept on them, and afterward his brothers talked with him. Excuse me, that's not the chapter I want. It has to be 48, chapters 15 and 16. Jacob, he blessed Joseph, and he said, "The God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. And may my name live on in them, the names of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and may they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." Jacob knew that God was directing his steps. And as he approached Haran, after that long journey of walking, Jacob came upon an isolated well in a field. The well was covered with a large stone, which was likely designed to keep the well from getting polluted. Okay? Verses 2 and 3 gives us the setting and the background. There were three flocks of sheep at that time as Jacob approached. No watering was taking place. The stone was still over the mouth of the well, and the sheep were lying there. Jacob engages the shepherds in a conversation, and in the process, he discovers where they're from, that they knew Laban, his uncle, that Laban has a daughter, at least one daughter, by the name of Rachel, who is a shepherdess by profession, trade, or occupation. And there are reasons why they're waiting to water the sheep. They're waiting for all the sheep to get there. By the way, this is just an aside. This is the first account of a female shepherd in the Bible. So in case you're in a game of biblical trivia and somebody asks you where's the first reference to a shepherdess in the Bible, it's Rachel. Now, later on in Exodus 2, we'll find that Jethro's daughters are also shepherdesses, but this is the first mention. So that's just your little bit of trivia for today. There's no charge for that. A well was a valuable resource. And as such, it had to belong to somebody. And that person or that clan would describe how and when the well was to be used. The agreement between the well owner and the shepherd seems to be, in this context, that the well could be used once a day, and it's once a day when all the shepherds have gathered with all the sheep. Because then there'd be enough man help. And perhaps the shepherds were young boys and didn't have the physical strength to move the stone, and it was going to take a number of them to do it. They could move the stone, water the sheep, and send them back on their way. So that's where we find Jacob as he enters into the surrounding area of Haran, and he's about to meet Rachel. Because while in discussion with the shepherds, verse 9, in the process of being in discussion and speaking with them, Rachel arrives. Jacob loses all interest in the shepherds. He's focused on one thing, the beauty of Rachel. All manner of custom and decorum are lost. It's swept aside. Jacob himself removes the stone, waters the flock, kisses Rachel, weeps, and introduces himself as a cousin. And you almost get the impression that it happened that fast. He ran over, moved the stone. Let's get these sheep watered. You know, I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe I'm seeing you. I'm Jacob. You're Rachel. Okay. Let's get on with this. It seems as though Jacob is a different man. He's not presented here as a manipulator. And he's not just a man who can remove the stone from the well, but he's thankful. The weeping seems to indicate joy and gratitude. His words to Rachel, the kiss on the cheek, the tears, perhaps of relief. He had been commissioned to go to Haran to find a wife, and the first woman he meets is beyond beautiful description. And she's a relative. So everything's falling into place. It appears, and if we were writing the story, we might call it love at first sight. Even if it wasn't, the stage is certainly set for the next phase of their relationship. Because as soon as they have met and become somewhat acquainted and the sheep have been fed, Rachel runs off to tell her father. And upon hearing that his sister's son, his nephew, has arrived, Laban runs out to meet him. He embraces him. He brings him into the house. Now, it is very possible that Laban is recalling the arrival of Abraham's servant when he came to procure a wife for Isaac. And when the servant came, he came with 10 camels, multiple servants of his own, and gifts, or to put it in our words, a wedding dowry to give. And it is very possible that Laban was anticipating when he ran out to meet Jacob that he would see 10 camels, servants, and get a dowry for one of his daughters. What he saw, however, was a lone man, and I suspect looking a little ragged. Jacob's mode of arrival would have portrayed more the image of a runaway or a fugitive, as opposed to the rich emissary of Laban's wealthy brother-in-law. That fact may literally have prompted Jacob to tell his story, because the text says, at the end of verse 13, he related to Laban all these things. What things? Well, I suspect, and although the text doesn't say specifically, that Jacob told his story. First of all, why he was alone, why there was nobody with him. So I think he told Laban that he had cheated his brother out of his birthright, that the reason he was alone is because his mother had sent him away so that Esau, his brother, didn't kill him, that he was a relative, but that along the way he had an encounter with God, and the Lord himself had reiterated the promises they had given to Abraham to him. And whether or not Jacob had ulterior motives, or whether he was simply trying to allay the fears that Laban may have had, we don't know. But we do know that as a result of Jacob telling his story, however much in detail he may have told it, Laban welcomed him into his house. And he stayed there for a month. That's all the text says. He was there for a month. He stayed with him at the end of verse 14 for a month. So another 30 days have passed, more or less. And Jacob's month-long stay with Laban does at least two things that we'll see played out in the process of the text that follows. First, it brings Jacob and Rachel into close contact over a prolonged period of time. They're in the same proximity to each other, the same household. So whatever affection they may have had when they first met at the well, that gets deepened because they're there together. Jacob has a reason to stay with Laban. Plus, he now has a roof over his head, or at least a tent, you know, food to eat. He'd been all alone for a long period of time walking. And secondly, this month-long stay proved to Laban that Jacob was a good worker. He'd make a fine son-in-law. He may not have had any money, but he could work. He could hang around the household, and he could do the chores that needed to get done. And so in place of a traditional dowry, gifts, camels, money, Jacob could provide his labor. That month brought Laban and Jacob to the conclusion then that their continuing relationship would be of mutual advantage. It'd be beneficial to both of them. In the second half of the chapter, now that they've met, been acquainted, spent a month together, begins in verse 15. Laban says to Jacob, "Because you're my relative, should you therefore serve for nothing? What should your wages be? What would you like to receive for all the labor that you've done over this past month? And if you're going to hang around, what do you want me to pay you? What do you want?" Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah. The name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were weak. I don't really like that translation. I'll tell you why in a minute. But Rachel was beautiful of form and face. Jacob loved Rachel. So he said to Laban, "I will serve you for 7 years if you'll give me your younger daughter Rachel in marriage." Laban's response, "It's better that I give her to you than I give her to another man. Stay." In other words, "That sounds like a really good deal to me. I'm in." So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her. Note that the text reminds us, or tells us, before Jacob actually gives his answer, that Laban had two daughters. Leah, the older, Rachel, the younger. And verse 17 gives us a description of these two women. Leah's eyes were weak, Rachel was beautiful of form and face. Most of the time, if you're in discussion with someone and you're looking at that text, or you've been in discussions with people about who Leah was and she had weak eyes, you think that she had a poor appearance. At best, she was homely. She may have been slightly on the ugly side from a physical perspective, because it's contrasted to Rachel's beauty of form. I would like to suggest a little different tact for you this morning to think about. That specific word, Hebrew word, that's translated here in the text, weak, is the Hebrew word rak, R-A-K. Okay? And it's never used in a demeaning way. It doesn't refer to any defect. Moses uses it in Genesis chapter 18 and verse 7, where Abraham, and this is the context where Abraham has the visitors, and he's going to prepare a meal for these special visitors because of the need for hospitality. And Abram also ran to the herd and took a tender, same word, tender and choice calf. Would Abraham have picked a weak, debilitated, deformed calf to sacrifice for his guests because of the value of hospitality? Absolutely not. This is one of the choice tasks, choice sheep to prepare and to give for a meal. It was a tender and choice calf. Interestingly enough, this word is also used in Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 1, a verse you know. A gentle answer turns away wrath. A harsh word stirs up anger. The gentle answer is the word rock. We would never translate a weak, debilitating, deformed answer turns away wrath. We'd never translate it that way. I'm convinced that if we were to take rock and all of its uses, which is unfortunately rendered weak here in New American Standard Translation, if we were to take it in its normal sense, we would not think of any terms of defect, but we would think of it in terms of delicate, tender, and soft. In contrast to Rachel, who may have had a fire or sparkle in his eyes, in her eyes, from Jacob's perspective, Leah had gentle eyes. Maybe Leah was just a little timid. I would conclude that the disposition of Leah was gentleness and tenderness. Rachel was a little more fiery and aggressive. We might even say that Leah was the more caring, tender woman. Rachel was the more outgoing, aggressive woman. Whatever the differences, in Jacob's eyes, there is no comparison, because he was head over heels for Rachel. That's all he could think about, and that's all he wanted. John.
I'd say that's probably the case because she's a shepherd. She
has to be aggressive. Yes. That does, doesn't it, when you think about it? It's interesting to note, by the way, that Rachel is always characterized by her physical attractiveness. There seems to be, in the big picture of Genesis, a significant contrast between Rachel and Rebecca. Rebecca was selected for Isaac by Abraham's servant on the basis of divine guidance and because of personal qualities that assured him that she would be a fine wife for Isaac. Rachel, on the other hand, was selected by Jacob for himself, by himself, without any mention of personal qualities outside of being a shepherdess. only a description of her beauty. Rebecca's beauty was an additional plus. One could say a fringe benefit. Rachel's beauty was the essence of her selection. Perhaps some red warning flag should have been highlighted at that particular point. And coupled with the fact that Jacob loved Rachel, or at least he loved her beauty, but here we see, if we can put it this way, perhaps some of the immaturity of Jacob because he was attracted only to the beauty of Rachel. And please let me understand there's nothing wrong with being attracted to beauty. We're all attracted, men, to our beautiful wives, and in our eyes, they are beautiful. Okay, we look for that. Men looks at the appearance. That's what we got, right? We can see that. And what young man wouldn't notice Rachel and be attracted to her? We are reminded in verse 18 that Jacob loved Rachel. And except in one cryptic phrase, just look in verse 30 for a second. Jacob went into Rachel also, and indeed he loved Rachel more than Leah. Doesn't say he didn't love Leah. So that's the cryptic phrase, he loved Rachel more than he loved Leah. He may have had some affection towards Leah. But that's the only time there's any implication that he even cared about Leah. But since Jacob was penniless, he had no means to take a wife, but he could contract his labor as a hired worker, substituting labor for the traditional betrothal gift presented by the groom. And Jacob is willing to work for 7 years. Verses 19 and 20 record Laban's agreement. And the 7 years pass without any further description in the text. Except the fact that, according to Jacob, it seemed like a few days. He loved Rachel so much that those 7 years passed like that. Didn't seem like more than a week. And it was over. If you go back to Rebecca's comment to Jacob when he left in chapter 27 and verse 44, she sent him away saying, "Stay with Laban for a few days." And when Rebecca said this, she had no understanding that she'd never see her son again. She sent him away for a few days. And Jacob loved Rachel so much that 7 years seemed like a few days. One can't fail to see the irony in the story and the phrases that's used, because a few days for Rebecca are a lifetime, but 7 years for Jacob are a few days. And things are about to radically change. Jacob, verse 21, at the end of those 7 years, says to Laban, "It's time for me to get married. My time is completed. I want to go into Rachel." Laban gathered all the men of the place and he made a feast. Now in the evening, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to him, and Jacob went into her. Laban also gave his maid Zilpha to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came about in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. And Jacob said to Laban, "What is this you've done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served with you? Why then have you deceived me?" But Laban says, "It is not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the firstborn. Complete the week of this one and we'll give you the other one for your service, which you shall serve for me for another 7 years." Jacob did so, completed her week, and gave her his daughter Rachel as his wife. Laban also gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her maid. So Jacob went into Rachel also, and indeed he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban for another 7 years. You can picture this event, right? This is made for Hollywood. Laban prepares a wedding feast. It includes a week of celebration. He invites the guest, In our terminology, he hires the band. Everybody's there. It's a week of celebration. On the wedding night, Laban does one of the most despicable things in history. He places Leah in place of Rachel, and he sends Jacob into the tent. Laban is proving himself to be as deceitful and maybe better at giving deceit than Jacob. While we don't know for certain, I get the impression that Laban planned this out. You know, sometimes you get asked, what's your 5-year plan? This was Laban's 7-year plan. I think from the beginning, Laban planned this out. It was ruminating in his mind how he was going to make this happen and marry off Leah before he married off Rachel. Jacob had pretended to be his older brother. Now Leah pretends to be her younger sister. Laban and Leah deceived Jacob as Jacob and Rebekah had deceived Isaac. How in the world could Jacob not know what woman he was spending the night with? That's the question that's usually asked, right? I know we're in a Bible class, but that's the question he's asking. This was a week-long feast. Maybe he had too much to eat and too much to drink. The tent was dark. May have been hard for him to see. It's not unusual for the bride on that night to have a veil. In our current cultural context, the burqa that a woman wears in the Middle East pretty much covers everything but her eyes. Isn't that interesting? And I think from Jacob's perspective, it never crossed his mind. Never even crossed his mind that it wouldn't be Rachel. As Jacob had deceived Isaac by taking advantage of his inability to see due to his poor eyesight, Laban deceived Jacob by taking advantage of his inability to see in the dark tent. While what Laban did was a monstrous act of treachery, it's not the first recorded in Genesis. One could make the point that treachery lies at the heart of the message of Genesis. Satan deceived Eve, who then dealt treacherously with Adam, although it was his choice. He should have known better. Cain dealt treacherously with Abel and killed him. Ham dealt treacherously with his father Noah and exposed him. Sarai dealt treacherously with her maid Hagar. Lot's daughters deceived their father and became pregnant. Rebekah deceived her husband Isaac, and Jacob deceived Esau, and Laban dealt treacherously with Jacob, Leah, and Rachel. You really could try to trace this theme all the way through. But stop for a moment and think about both Rachel and Leah on this night. Consider how Rachel must have felt. She had looked forward to this night for 7 years. Then at the last minute, at least from her perspective, the last minute, she has to watch the man she thought she was going to marry enter the tent and know that her sister was in there. What a contemptible thing Laban did. But then consider Leah. Personally, I think what Laban did to her was worse than what he did to Rachel. He took a perfectly wonderful woman and cast her in the role of a cheap imposter, certain to incur the wrath, if not the hatred, of the husband she was deceiving. So the morning after the wedding arrives, Jacob is shocked to discover that Leah was his wife and not Rachel. He must have been livid, beyond angry. And so he confronts Laban. Look at verse 25. "What is this you have done to me. He clearly places the blame on Laban, not Leah. Why have you deceived me? He says at the end of verse 25. And Laban's response must have startled Jacob and literally pierced his heart. Because notice what he says. It's not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the firstborn. That phrase reminded Jacob, the younger, who had deceived the firstborn in his family. Couldn't help but think of the prophet Nathan coming into David after David had committed his act of adultery with Bathsheba. And Nathan comes in with the story about the rich man who stole the poor lamb from the poor man who only had one and sacrificed it so he could feed a guest. And David is so livid that he wants to kill the man. And Nathan says, "You're the man." And David's heart was pierced. And I think at this moment, Jacob's heart was pierced. Jacob was as guilty as Laban. And Jacob had nothing else to say. Laban, however, wasn't through with his treachery. "Jacob, you can still have Rachel as a second wife. You just have to work for another 7 years, but guess what? You don't have to wait 7 years for another wedding night. You can have her in a week." So a week after his first wedding, Jacob gets another wedding. I'm sure it was not near as elaborate. And Rachel becomes his wife. Because Jacob loved Rachel, he was willing to deal with that. What a great start to a happy family. I mean, there is nothing good between relationships that's going to come out of this at this particular start. It's destined for tension and trouble. Rachel gets cheated out of her wedding, the one she'd waited 7 years for. Leah's always going to feel like a second-class wife. She's the substitute. Jacob is always going to be torn between these two women. Actually, it'll be four, because each of the servants bears children to Jacob as well. And Laban is shown to be the con man that he is. What kind of relationship is he going to have with both daughters? Do you think they're going to want to go visit? Notice in verse 31, the Lord saw that Leah was unloved. When Jacob arrived in Haran, he saw a well, and he saw Rachel, same word. His sight caused him to act on his own behalf. He disregarded the traditions surrounding the use of the well, and he disregarded the traditions surrounding the younger over the, or the older over the younger. However, when God saw that Leah was unloved, he acted on her behalf. He opened her womb. Rachel was barren. Leah gave birth to a son, Reuben. She was hoping that that would cause Jacob to love her. Didn't work out that well. She gave birth to a second son, Simeon. Then she gave birth to a third son, Levi, who became the priestly tribe. She gave birth to a fourth son, Judah, from whom the Messiah came. It's not until we come to the next chapter that the conflict escalates as both Rachel and Leah again and her handmaids all bear sons. That's next week's lesson. Maybe. Rocky.
Just for the record, the title of next week's lesson the baby born.
In the Bible Knowledge Commentary, the author says, God chose the despised mother Leah and exalted her to be the first mother. The kingly tribe of Judah and the priestly tribe of Levi trace back to her. She may not have been loved by Jacob, but she was loved by God. And God cared for his people. It's also interesting to note that Rachel, even though the younger, died an early age. She was buried on the way back to Bethlehem. Leah died much later, and she was buried with Jacob, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, and Rebekah in the cave of Machpelah. The honored place of death, the honored burial grounds. Far from being a blight to Jacob, Leah really was a blessing. I think to recognize that, you don't always see her from that perspective. But I think she had a tender, caring, compassionate heart, and I think that showed in her long life and the blessing that God gave her to Jacob. Let me give a couple concluding thoughts for you to take home. Again, I think in the context of what you're looking at when you run through the book of Genesis over and over again, in the background or in the forefront, is the grace of God. We may see Jacob's time in Haran about 20 years, by the way, the whole time the thing took place, as exile and punishment for the way he had treated his brother. But in a very real sense, it's God's protection for Jacob because Esau wanted to kill him. So God keeps him away from the setting where danger could have come. And again, while Leah was not Jacob's chosen wife, she was blessed with six sons, among whom was Judah, through whom, as I mentioned earlier, the Messiah would come. One writer said Jacob may have been guided by his hormones, but God was gracious and sovereign in his life. Second, there's really a biblical principle that's at play here in the life of Jacob. It's a biblical principle that can be found in the book of Galatians. Galatians chapter 6, verses 7 and 8. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, this he will also reap. For the one who sows to his own flesh will reap from the flesh corruption, but the one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life. The laws of the harvest are at play. If you sow corn seed, you're not getting an apple tree. Now, if you sow acorns, you're not getting corn. You reap what you sow. It's a principle that works out in nature. It's a principle that works out in life. There's a correlation between the decisions a man makes and the results that can be expected from those decisions. Jacob, Laban, Rebecca can probably be included in that, fell into the trap of thinking they could outsmart God's plan. Don't fall into that trap. Not a good place to be. Jacob thought he could outsmart his father Isaac and his brother Esau. Laban thought he could outsmart Jacob and his two daughters. Both, or all, had to reap the consequences. And while it may have been years from the initial deception to payback, if you will, there were still consequences. We've all watched enough television that we'd love it when the bad guy finally gets his comeuppance. You know, he gets paid back for what he'd done. You know, if he cheated someone else and he gets cheated, we feel good about that. There was an old television show called Leverage. Did you ever see the old TV show called Leverage? And that was this whole group of people were getting back, getting even paying back the person who had stolen from, cheated, or done something wrong to somebody else, and they figured a way to get this person back. And I've watched that enough to think, yeah, that's what I want to see. So we felt good when Jacob got what he deserved. But we forget lives are involved with that. Leah, Rachel, the sons that came, the conflict and the tension that's the result of all of that deception and treachery. You reap what you sow. So here's your question. You know, Jace often says, here's your question to take with you for the week. Well, here's my question for you to take with you for the week. What does it mean to sow to the Spirit? And how do you do that? Because if the scriptures say, but the one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap life. We know what it's like to sow to the flesh. We've all done it. And reap the consequences of some of those choices. But what does it mean to sow to the Spirit? I'm not going to give you the answer. I just want you to think about that as a principle, because the result of sowing to the Spirit is life. He calls it eternal life, but it's life. It's living well. So what does that mean and what does that look like? So that'll be your homework assignment to meditate, ruminate, contemplate, discuss, or whatever during the week. Any questions, comments, thoughts, commentary? John. Yeah, he could have.
Why 7 years? And you answer it, God's plan. Well, he stays away from Esau. That makes sense. But I just want to word, does anyone say why 7 years? Is that, doesn't seem to be?
I did not come across any definitive answer to that in my research. Joe?
I don't know that it's a definitive answer, but I think it is an honor. It's showing how much honor he thinks Rachel is worth. That 7 days would have been an insult to Rachel. And she's thinking, that's what you think?
I'm worth 7 days? Yeah, okay. And seven has a number of significance in terms of culture and value that makes perfect sense. That I'm going to give her the highest honor I can, and that's the best number I can come up with.
Well, four times seven is 28, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we lived in Michigan, we lived in a townhouse. My study was in the basement. The living area and kitchen was up here, and then our bedroom was up in the another set of stairs. So one night after studying till gosh, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, Linda was pregnant at the time. I'm heading up to bed, and just as I rounded the corner from the stairs coming up out of the basement, I see her coming down the stairs with a little overnight bag. And I thought, oh no. So